38. Cranes and skyhooks. Lifting in design space. Life is amazing. When you think of the billions of solar systems that are almost certainly entirely lifeless, it is amazing that there is any way of being alive at all. And it is amazing to reflect on the variety of different ways of being alive, from bacteria to fish, birds, daisies, whales, snakes, maples, and people. Perhaps most amazing of all is the tenacity of living things, the thousands of ways they have of clinging to life and reproducing, eking out a living against formidable obstacles, thanks to millions of ingenious devices and arrangements, from the convoluted cascades of protein machinery within every cell to echolocation in bats, to the elephant's trunk, to the capacity of our brains to reflect on every topic under the sun, and many others as well. All that magnificent adjustment of means to ends requires an explanation, since it cannot be pure chance or happenstance. There are only two known possibilities: intelligent design or evolution by natural selection. In either case, there is a tremendous amount of design work to be done, either miraculously by an intelligent designer, or ploddingly, unforesightedly, stupidly, but non-miraculously by natural selection. Call the design work R&D, the standard abbreviation in industry for research and development, and recognize that R&D is always costly. It takes time and energy. The beauty of Darwin's great idea is that he saw how, given billions of years in which to work, and a prodigious amount of waste motion, zillions of trials ending in errors, design improvements could non-miraculously accumulate, automatically, without intention or foresight or understanding. Robert Beverly McKenzie, one of Darwin's most ardent critics, put it eloquently. In the theory with which we have to deal, absolute ignorance is the artificer, so that we may enunciate as the fundamental principle of the whole system that, in order to make a perfect and beautiful machine, it is not requisite to know how to make it. This proposition will be found, on careful examination, to express in condensed form the essential purport of the theory, and to express in a few words all Mr. Darwin's meaning, who, by a strange inversion of reasoning, seems to think absolute ignorance fully qualified to take the place of absolute wisdom in all the achievements of creative skill. 1868. Exactly. And ever since Darwin proposed this amazing idea, skeptics have wondered whether there was enough time to do all that creative work the plodding way. A convenient way to imagine the design work that needs to have been done is to think of it as lifting in design space. What is design space? Like the Library of Babel and the Library of Mendel, it can best be conceived as a multidimensional space. In fact, design space contains both of those libraries and more, because it includes not only all the designed authored books and all the designed evolved organisms, but all other things that are well described by the design stance. See Chapter 18, such as houses, mousetraps, battle axes, computers, and spaceships. And just as most of the Library of Babel is gibberish, most of the places in design space are filled with junk, things that can't do anything well at all. If you are like me, you can imagine just three dimensions at a time. But the more you play around with the idea in your imagination, the easier it gets to think of the familiar three dimensions as standing in for many. This is a thinking tool that improves with practice. When we imagine placing the Tree of Life in the Library of Mendel, we can see how all the living things that have ever actually existed on this planet are connected to each other by lines of descent. Those lineages transmit the basic design improvements, discovered by natural selection, preserving the earliest R&D for use in all subsequent living things. The machinery inside every cell, from bacteria to brain cells, includes thousands of brilliantly designed nanodevices that have been cranking away for over 3 billion years. The basic engine room of life that we share with trees and birds and yeast cells. At the multicell level, we find hearts, lungs, eyes, arms, legs, and wings reusing and improving on designs that were first developed only 2 billion years ago. But in addition to the parts of organisms, there are the artifacts of organisms, spider webs and bird nests and beaver dams, for example. These also show unmistakable evidence of R&D. And the fruits of that R&D have to have been transmitted somehow along the same lineage lines, either in the genes or by offspring copying their parents. Every now and then a novelty arises, by mutation or experimentation or accident, that is an improvement, and it gets copied and copied and copied. Failed experiments go extinct. Again, publish or perish. Then there are the human artifacts, the plows and bridges and cathedrals, the paintings, plays, poems, and printing presses, the airplanes and computers and lawnmowers and the thinking tools. What about them? Do they not hang off the branches of one part of the tree of life, the human lineage? Each of them depends on at least one author or inventor, and most depend on uncounted thousands or millions of contributors to the R&D that lies behind them. Beethoven didn't have to invent the symphony, which was already there for him to adapt, and Shakespeare didn't have to invent the sonnet. A chainsaw is composed of dozens or hundreds of off-the-shelf elements already invented, already optimized. Some of our human artifacts are probably copied from the artifacts of other animals. Did the weaver bird's nest inspire the invention of weaving cloth? Was the raised snow shelf on the floor of an Inuit igloo, which permits the cold air to drain out the lower entryway, copied from the similar raised floor in polar bear dens? Or are these independent inventions? Or did polar bears copy from the Inuit? The deep similarities of function between hearts and pumps, bat echolocation and sonar and radar, beaver dams and irrigation dams, eyes and cameras are no accident. Similar processes of exploration of R&D have shaped and honed and improved them over the centuries. Put them all in common space, design space, the space of all possible designs. This move is contentious among biologists, for reasons I think I understand and deplore. Many biologists are extremely reluctant to talk about design in living things because they think it gives aid and comfort to the intelligent design movement, that disingenuous, pseudo-scientific, crypto-religious campaign to undermine the richly deserved authority of evolutionary biology. Among these resistors are two of my most esteemed colleagues and friends, evolutionary biologists Richard Dawkins and Jerry Coyne. By speaking of purpose and design in nature, we apparently give the intelligent design gang half their case. It is better, some think, to maintain a stern embargo on such themes and insist that, strictly speaking, nothing in the biosphere is designed unless it is designed by human artificers. Nature's way of generating complex systems, organs, behaviors, is so unlike an artificer's way, they think, that we should not use the same language to describe them. Thus, Richard Dawkins speaks, on occasion, for example, 1996, page 4, of designoid features of organisms. And in The Ancestor's Tale, 2004, page 457, he says, "The illusion of design conjured by Darwinian natural selection is so breathtakingly powerful." I disagree with this policy of austerity, which can backfire badly. I recently overheard a conversation among some young people in a bar about the marvels of the nanomachinery discovered inside all cells. "When you see all those fantastic little robots working away, how can you possibly believe in evolution?" one exclaimed, and another nodded wisely. Somehow these folks had gotten the impression that evolutionary biologists thought that life wasn't all that complex, wasn't made of components that were all that wonderful. These evolution doubters were not rednecks. They were Harvard medical students. They hugely underestimated the power of natural selection because evolutionary biologists had told them again and again that there is no actual design in nature, only the appearance of design. This episode strongly suggested to me that common knowledge is beginning to incorporate the mistaken idea that evolutionary biologists are reluctant to admit or acknowledge all the obvious design in nature. Consider in this regard Christoph Schönborn, Catholic Archbishop of Vienna, the chap duped by the intelligent design folks. He wrote, notoriously, in a New York Times op-ed piece titled "Finding Design in Nature," "The Catholic Church, while leaving to science many details about the history of life on Earth, proclaims that by the light of reason, the human intellect can readily and clearly discern purpose and design in the natural world, including the world of living things. Evolution in the sense of common ancestry might be true, but evolution in the neo-Darwinian sense, an unguided, unplanned process of random variation and natural selection, is not. Any system of thought that denies or seeks to explain away the overwhelming evidence for design in biology is ideology, not science. Which campaign do we evolutionists want to lead? Do we want to try to convince laypeople that they don't really see the design that is stunningly obvious at every scale in biology? Or would we rather try to show that, wonderful to say, what Darwin has shown is that there can be design, real design, as real as it gets, without an intelligent designer? We have persuaded the world that the Earth goes around the sun and that time is relative, not absolute. Why shrink from the pedagogical task of showing that there can be design without a designer? So I am defending here, once again with new emphasis, the following claim. The biosphere is utterly saturated with design, with purpose, with reasons. What I call the design stance predicts and explains features throughout the living world using the same assumptions that work so well when we are reverse engineering artifacts made by somewhat intelligent human designers. Evolution by natural selection is a set of processes that find and track reasons for things to be arranged one way rather than another. The chief difference between the reasons found by evolution and the reasons found by human designers is that the latter are typically, but not always, represented in the minds of the designers, whereas the reasons uncovered by natural selection are typically represented for the first time by the human investigators who succeed in reverse engineering nature's productions. That is to say, human designers think about the reasons for the features of their artifacts and hence have ideas that represent the reasons. They typically notice, appreciate, formulate, refine, and then convey, discuss, criticize the reasons for their designs. Evolution doesn't do any of this. It just sifts mindlessly through the variation it generates, and the good stuff, which is good for reasons, reasons undreamed of or unrepresented by the process of natural selection, gets copied. There could be a good use for the term designoid to mark merely apparent design, but it is not in biology. When I think of the mere appearance of design, I think of how cartoonists set the stage for cartoons about scientists by showing some bearded egghead standing in front of a blackboard covered with, actually nonsensical symbols, or in a chemistry lab stocked with an impressive-looking forest of tubes and beakers, or by showing us the mad inventor working on his time machine bristling with dials and antennas and high-tech gizmos. These things couldn't actually do any work. They only appear to be functional. But the designs of nature are truly effective. In fact, they are often demonstrably much more efficient and powerful than any human design counterpart yet invented. A healthy young man can walk, carrying all the food and water he needs to survive for about a week, stopping and resting whenever he chooses, traveling perhaps 150 miles. Water is the key burden. Carrying 50 pounds of water and 16 pounds of food and 10 pounds of gear makes a very heavy pack. If he could find water on the way, he could go for months. For comparison, consider the brainchild of Cornell University roboticist Andy Arena and his colleagues, who have built by far the longest walking robot, Ranger, which traveled nonstop 65.2 kilometers, 40.5 miles, in a robot ultramarathon in Japan on May 1st and 2nd, 2011. Ranger's designers take advantage of the dynamical properties of limbs to create a superbly energy-efficient walker, around and around on a flat track for hours on end, guided by a human being with a joystick. Another magnificent four-legged walker robot, Big Dog, is about 15 times less energy-efficient, but has much more impressive capacities to accommodate difficult terrain. Humans are still considerably more efficient transport devices than Ranger by a factor of 4 or 5, and unlike Ranger, they can respond autonomously to all manner of features in the world. See Ruina, 2011. Something has to give. Either we define design as the product of an intelligent designer, such as a designer of poems or cars, for instance, or we acknowledge that there can be design, genuine design, without an intelligent designer. Tradition and etymology might seem to favor the former course, but consider this. Adam, from the Greek, a, without, plus tomos, from Temnian, to cut or slice. atom originally meant unsplittable thing, but science discovered that splitting the atom, after all, was not a contradiction in terms. Science has also discovered, I submit, that design without a designer, lacking a designer with a mind, with foresight and intention, is not only possible, but all around us. Design by evolution is a real, well-understood process. It differs in interesting ways from design by engineer, but it is also deeply similar, capable of humbling ingenuity. Time and again, biologists, baffled by some apparently futile or maladroit bit of bad design in nature, have eventually come to see that they have underestimated the sheer brilliance in one of Mother Nature's creations. Francis Crick mischievously baptized this trend in the name of a colleague, Leslie Orgel, speaking of what he called Orgel's second law: evolution is cleverer than you are. This apparently reckless tactic of personifying the process of natural selection as Mother Nature, this in-your-face anthropomorphizing, will be defended in due course. It is not just an entertaining metaphor. It is a thinking tool in its own right. Back to design space, the multidimensional space of all possible designs, including not just the actual organisms and automobiles and poems, but, like the books in the Library of Babel, all the never-evolved, never-constructed designs, the talking kangaroos and flying snakes, nuclear-powered popcorn poppers and underwater roller skates. What should our alphabet of basic design elements be? Since we aren't going to try to make design space, but just think about it, we might as well be profligate. Let's say all possible configurations of atoms, drawn from the periodic table of elements — this vast space will include atom-for-atom duplicates of all the undesigned things as well, such as every pebble on every beach and Mount Everest, but that is as it should be, since there is nothing to prevent somebody from deciding to design and build replicas of these entities. Where will Brahms's Third Symphony be in design space? Well, the score, in spots of ink on paper, etc., will be in gazillions of places, and tape recordings and vinyl stereo records will be in others. So it will be in design space for sure. A song that was never written down or recorded, but rather preserved and transmitted in an oral tradition, will be harder to tie down to families of atoms. But a suitably convoluted subsection of design space, over time, will house it well enough. Just as the Library of Babel is filled mainly with junk, unreadable books of nonsense, design space is filled mainly with nonsensical stuff of no interest or function or competence at all, but here and there, vanishingly thin threads of actual and possible design shine through. Things that can do things, aside from just waiting around to crumble under the inexorable edict of the second law of thermodynamics. With just this roughed-out idea of design space in our heads, we can now see, at a glance, how to frame a series of questions that have haunted debate about evolution ever since Darwin's time. Are there any actual designs, natural or artificial, that are not ultimately derived from that single tree of life, either directly or indirectly? Here are some answers to consider. 1. No. 2. Yes. Some marvels of nature are just too wonderful, too irreducibly complex to have been arrived at by the plodding, uphill process of design by evolution. They must have been independently created by an intelligent designer. 3. Yes, some human artifacts, such as the plays of Shakespeare and Gödel's theorem, are too wonderful to be mere products of evolved human brains. They are works of miraculous genius and are inexplicable by, unreachable by, the plodding, uphill process of design by evolution. We can characterize answers 2 and 3 as relying heavily on the contrast between the utterly inefficient, plodding process of natural selection, absolute ignorance, as Mackenzie called it, and the swift, apparently effortless brilliance of Mozart, or any other godlike genius you choose. Chapter 49 explores this. Using our analogy between lifting and R&D, we can say that they each proclaim the need for a skyhook. Skyhook, origin, aeronaut, an imaginary contrivance for attachment to the sky, an imaginary means of suspension in the sky, Oxford English Dictionary. The first use noted by the Oxford English Dictionary is dated 1915, an aeroplane pilot commanded to remain in place, aloft, for another hour replies, "The machine is not fitted with skyhooks." The skyhook concept is perhaps a descendant of the deus ex machina of ancient Greek dramaturgy, when second-rate playwrights found their plots leading their heroes into inescapable difficulties, they were often tempted to crank down a god onto the scene, like Superman, to save the situation supernaturally. Or skyhooks may be an entirely independent creation of convergent folkloric evolution. Skyhooks would be wonderful things to have, great for lifting unwieldy objects out of difficult circumstances and speeding up all sorts of construction projects. Sad to say, they are impossible. There are cranes, however. Cranes can do the lifting work our imaginary skyhooks might do, and they do it in an honest, non-question-begging fashion. They are expensive, though. They have to be designed and built from everyday parts already on hand, and they have to be located on a firm base of existing ground. Skyhooks are miraculous lifters, unsupported and insupportable. Cranes are no less excellent as lifters, and they have the advantage of being real. Anyone who, like me, is a lifelong onlooker at construction sites will have noticed with some satisfaction that it sometimes takes a small crane to set up a big crane. And it must have occurred to many other onlookers that, in principle, this big crane could be used to enable or speed up the building of a still more spectacular crane. Cascading cranes is a tactic that seldom, if ever, gets used more than once in real-world construction projects. But in principle, there is no limit to the number of cranes that could be organized in series to accomplish some mighty end. Now imagine all the lifting that has to get done in design space to create the magnificent organisms and other artifacts we encounter in our world. Huge distances must have been traversed since the dawn of life with the earliest, simplest, self-replicating entities, spreading outward, diversity, and upward, excellence. Darwin has offered us an account of the crudest, most rudimentary, stupidest imaginable lifting process, the wedge or inclined plane of natural selection. By taking tiny, the tiniest possible steps, this process can gradually, over eons, traverse these huge distances, or so Darwin claims. At no point would anything miraculous, from on high, be needed. Each step has been accomplished by brute, mechanical, algorithmic climbing, from the base already built by the efforts of earlier climbing. It does seem incredible. Could it really have happened? Or did the process need a leg up now and then? Perhaps only at the very beginning, from one sort of skyhook or another. For over a century, skeptics have been trying to find proof that Darwin's idea just can't work, at least not all the way. They have been hoping and hunting for skyhooks as exceptions to what they see as the bleak vision of Darwin's algorithm churning away. And time and again, they have come up with truly interesting challenges, leaps and gaps and other marvels that do seem, at first, to need skyhooks. But then along have come the cranes, discovered in many cases by the very skeptics who were hoping to find a skyhook. It is time for some more careful definitions. Let us understand that a skyhook is a mind-first force, or power or process, an exception to the principle that all design, and apparent design, is ultimately the result of mindless, motiveless mechanicity. A crane, in contrast, is a subprocess or a special feature of a design process that can be demonstrated to permit the local speeding up of the basic slow process of natural selection, and that can be demonstrated to be itself the predictable, or retrospectively explicable, product of the basic process. Some cranes are obvious and uncontroversial. Others are still being argued about, very fruitfully. Just to give a general sense of the breadth and application of the concept, let me point to three very different examples. Symbiosis is a crane. One of my favorite examples is the symbiotic origin of the eukaryotic cell. If you look at the tree of life, you will notice that the glorious fan-out of multicellular life, including all plants and animals, occurs after the evolution of eukaryotes. For about a billion years on this planet, the only living things were single-celled organisms, bacteria and archaea, together known as prokaryotes. Then, one lucky day, one prokaryote happened to bump into another, It no doubt happened very often then, as it still does today. And instead of one of them engulfing and dismantling the other, eating it, or repelling it, the two joined forces, forming a brand new kind of living thing with roughly twice as many working parts and a greater variety of working parts. Two R&D lineages that had been chugging along separately for millions of years, each honing its own peculiar talents, came together, and the result was, happened to be, an overnight success. Technology transfer does not always or even often yield good results, but when it does, it can be spectacular. Neither lineage had to go to the plodding trouble of reinventing all the tricks and systems of the other, and since the combination of their talents happened to be a net gain, synergy is the buzzword for this, this eukaryote, good plus cell, was fitter than either by itself. So the lineage of eukaryotes prospered. The claim that the origin of eukaryotes was such an event of symbiosis used to be controversial, but so many lines of evidence support it that it is now solidly in the textbooks. It would be gratifying to report that the origin of the bacterium flagellum, long the flagship example of irreducible complexity among the intelligent design crowd, has also proved to be due to the helping crane of symbiosis. And although Lynn Margulis, the late biologist and champion of the symbiotic origin of the eukaryotes, vigorously defended this claim, the evidence currently favors alternative evolutionary accounts of the source of the flagellum. Given this embarrassment of riches, the claim that flagella need a skyhook is looking particularly forlorn now. As we can see at a glance in the Tree of Life, eukaryotes set the stage for all of multicellular life. All the multicolored lineages to the right of the bacteria and archaea are eukaryotes. To a first approximation, every living thing that can be seen by the naked eye is a eukaryote. The eukaryotic revolution opened up huge regions of design space, but it did not happen in order to make all the designs accessible. Cranes must be paid for locally, in terms of the immediate benefits they convey to those that have the design innovations. But once established, they can have profound further effects. Similarly, computers were not invented in order to make word processing and the internet possible. But once the space of possible computer applications was rendered accessible, design processes went into overdrive, creating all the species we now rely on every day. Evolutionary theorists now generally agree that sex is a crane. Species that reproduce sexually can move through design space at a greater speed than species that reproduce asexually. Moreover, they can discern design improvements along the way that are all but invisible to asexually reproducing species. Holland, 1975. This cannot be the raison d'etre of sex, however. Evolution cannot see way down the road, so anything it builds must have an immediate payoff to counterbalance the cost. As recent theorists have insisted, the choice of reproducing sexually carries a huge immediate cost. Organisms send along only 50% of their genes in any one transaction, to say nothing of the effort and risk involved in securing a transaction in the first place. So the long-term payoff of heightened efficiency, acuity, and speed of the redesign process, the features that make sex a magnificent crane, is as nothing to the myopic, local competitions that must determine which organisms get favored in the very next generation. Some other short-term benefit must have maintained the positive selection pressure required to make sexual reproduction an offer few species could refuse. There are a variety of compelling and competing hypotheses that might solve this puzzle, which was first forcefully posed for biologists by John Maynard Smith, 1978. For a lucid introduction to this important topic in evolutionary biology, see Matt Ridley's book, The Red Queen, Sex and the Education of Human Nature, 1993. Sex reveals that a crane of great power may exist that was not created in order to exploit that power. It was created for other reasons, although its power as a crane may help explain why it has been maintained ever since. A crane that was obviously created to be a crane is genetic engineering. Genetic engineers can now unquestionably take huge leaps through design space, creating organisms that would never have evolved by ordinary means. This is no miracle, provided that genetic engineers, and the artifacts they use in their trade are themselves wholly the products of earlier, slower evolutionary processes. If the creationists were right that mankind is a species unto itself, divine and inaccessible via brute Darwinian paths, then genetic engineering would not be a crane after all, having been created with the help of a major skyhook. I don't imagine that any genetic engineers think of themselves this way, but it is a logically available perch, however precarious. Less obviously silly is this idea. If the bodies of genetic engineers are products of evolution, but their minds can do creative things that are irreducibly non-algorithmic or inaccessible by all algorithmic paths, then the leaps of genetic engineering might involve a skyhook. We will briefly explore this prospect later. 39. Competence without comprehension. Mackenzie described Darwin's idea of absolute ignorance being the source of all the achievements of creative skill as a strange inversion of reasoning, since it turns upside down one of the most obvious ideas we have. Comprehension is the source of competence. Why do we send our children to school, and why do we emphasize concepts over rote learning? Because we think that the best route to competence in any sphere of activity is comprehension. Don't settle for being a mindless drudge. Understand the principles of whatever we're doing so we can do it better. This is surely excellent advice in most arenas of human activity. We recognize extreme exceptions, such as gifted musicians who play by ear and can't read a note of music, or natural athletes who always seem to do the best thing but can't explain how or why they do it, and hence can't coach others. Then there are idiot savants with bizarre combinations of incompetence in most regards and superhuman prowess in some limited domain. But in general, the rule of thumb is hard to deny. Comprehension is usually the key to human competence. And Darwin really does invert that reasoning, showing, as Mackenzie so vividly put it, that absolute ignorance is the artificer. The process of natural selection is breathtakingly competent. Think of Orgel's second law, but utterly mindless. Moreover, the organisms it designs get the benefits of all their exquisite equipment without needing to understand why or how they are so gifted. My favorite example is the cuckoo. Cuckoos are brood parasites that don't make their own nests. Instead, the female cuckoo surreptitiously lays her eggs in the nest of a host pair of some other species of birds, where it awaits the attentions of its unwittingly adoptive parents. Often, the female cuckoo will roll one of the host eggs out of the nest, just in case the host parents can count. And as soon as the cuckoo chick is hatched, and it tends to incubate more quickly than the host eggs, the fledgling cuckoo goes to great efforts to roll any remaining eggs out of the nest. Why? To maximize the attention it will get from its adoptive parents. 40. Free-floating rationales. Natural selection is an automatic reason finder. It discovers and endorses and focuses reasons over many generations. The scare quotes are to remind us that natural selection doesn't have a mind, doesn't itself have reasons. But it is nevertheless competent to perform this task of design refinement. This is itself an instance of competence without comprehension. Let's just be sure we know how to cash out the scare quotes. Consider a population with lots of variation in it. Some members of the population do well at multiplying. Most do not. In each case, we can ask, why? Why did this one have surviving offspring while these others did not? In many cases, most cases, there is no reason at all. It's just dumb luck, good or bad. But if there is a subset, perhaps a very small one, of cases in which there is an answer, a difference that happens to make a difference, then what those cases have in common provides the germ of a reason. This permits functionality to accumulate by a process that blindly tracks reasons, creating things that have purposes but don't need to know them. The need-to-know principle reigns in the biosphere, and natural selection itself doesn't need to know what it's doing. So there were reasons before there were reason representers. The reasons tracked by evolution I have called free-floating rationales, a term that has apparently jangled the nerves of more than a few thinkers who suspect I am conjuring up ghosts of some sort, strange immaterial ideas that have no business appearing in a sober materialist's account of reality. Not at all. Free-floating rationales are no more ghostly or problematic than numbers or centers of gravity. There were 9 planets before people invented ways of articulating arithmetic, and asteroids had centers of gravity before there were physicists to dream up the idea and calculate with it. It is a mistake to confuse numbers with the numerals, Arabic or Roman or whatever, that we use as their names. Numerals are human inventions. Numbers are not. Reasons, in the sense I am using the term, are like numbers, not numerals. We should all be happy to speak of the reasons uncovered by evolution before they were ever expressed or represented by human investigators or any other minds. The termite castle and Antoni Gaudi's La Sagrada Familia are very familiar in shape, but utterly different in genesis and construction. There are reasons for the structures and shapes of the termite castle, but they are not represented by any of the termites. There is no architect termite who planned the structure, nor do any individual termites have the slightest clue about why they build the way they do. Competence without comprehension. There are also reasons for the structures and shapes of Gaudi's masterpiece, but they are, in the main, Gaudi's reasons. Gaudi had reasons for the shapes he ordered created. There are reasons for the shapes created by the termites, but the termites don't have those reasons. There are reasons why trees spread their branches, but they are not in any strong sense the tree's reasons. Sponges do things for reasons, bacteria do things for reasons, even viruses do things for reasons, but they don't have the reasons, they don't need to have the reasons. There are reasons aplenty for these behaviors, but in general, organisms need not understand them. They are endowed with behaviors that are well designed by evolution, and they are the beneficiaries of these designs without needing to know about it. This feature is everywhere to be seen in nature, but it tends to be masked by our tendency, adopting the intentional stance, to interpret behavior as more mindful and rational than it really is. How clever the termites are to air-condition their castles with well-placed ventilation shafts. How sagacious the squirrel is to store away food for the winter. How wily the pickerel is to hover motionless as its prey approaches. These are indeed excellent strategies for success in the unrelentingly competitive world of nature, but their beneficiaries need not appreciate what we do when we figure them out. We are the first minds to represent the reasons that account for the success of these arrangements. 41. Do locusts understand prime numbers? Just to drive home the point about the independence of numbers and numerals, free-floating rationales and represented reasoning, consider the case of the 17-year locusts. In 1977, Stephen Jay Gould wrote an insightful and admiring chapter about the curious fact that cicadas, such as the 17-year locust, have reproductive cycles with lengths in years equal to prime numbers, 13 years or 17, but never 15 or 16, for instance. As evolutionists, Gould, page 99, says, we seek answers to the question, why? Why, in particular, should such striking synchronicity evolve? And why should the period between episodes of sexual reproduction be so long? The answer, which makes beautiful sense in retrospect, is that by having a large prime number of years between appearances, the cicadas minimize the likelihood of being discovered and later tracked as a predictable feast by predators who themselves show up every 2 years or 3 years or 5 years. If the cicadas had a periodicity of, say, 16 years, then they would be a rare treat for predators who showed up every year, but a more reliable source of food for predators who showed up every 2 or 4 years, and an even money gamble for predators who got in phase with them on an 8-year schedule. If the length of their reproductive period is not a multiple of any lower number, however, they are not worth trying to track for any species that isn't lucky enough to have exactly the same periodicity, or some multiple of it. The mythical 34-year locust muncher would be in Fat City. It should be clear that the soundness of this explanation, which may not yet be established, does not depend on any hypothesis suggesting that locusts understand arithmetic, let alone prime numbers. Nor does it depend on the process of natural selection understanding prime numbers. The mindless, uncomprehending process of natural selection can exploit this important property of some numbers without having to understand it at all. For another example, neither bees nor Mother Nature need to understand the geometry that declares the hexagon the ideal shape for cells in a honeycomb. Many more examples of evolution's mathematical competence without comprehension could be cited. 42. How to explain stotting. Remember the baffling regularity revealed in the intuition pump about the two black boxes? You didn't have to have a semantic or intentional interpretation of the boxes to see it. Alpha caused red, and beta caused green. An obvious pattern in need of explanation. In each instance of button pressing, the scientists understood exactly how each step in the computing and transmitting process worked, but they couldn't explain the generalization. You do need a semantic interpretation to explain why the regularity exists. In other words, the macrocausal level at which the explanation is expressed does not reduce to the microcausal level. Here is another instance of this very general phenomenon. You have probably seen video of gazelles being chased across the plain by a predator, and noticed that some of the gazelles are leaping high into the air during their attempts to escape their pursuer. This is called stotting. Why do gazelles stot? It is clearly beneficial because gazelles that stot seldom get caught and eaten. This is a causal regularity that has been carefully observed, just like the regularity between buttons and lights, and it too can baffle. No account of the actions of all the proteins and all the cells of all the gazelles and the predators chasing them could reveal why this regularity exists. For that, we need the branch of evolutionary theory known as costly signaling theory, Zahavi 1987, Fitzgibbon and Fanshawe 1988. The strongest and fastest of the gazelles stot to advertise their fitness to the pursuer, signaling in effect, "Don't bother chasing me, I'm too hard to catch. Concentrate on one of my cousins who isn't able to stot. A much easier meal." And the pursuer takes this to be an honest, hard-to-fake signal and ignores the stotter. This is the free-floating rationale, and it need not be appreciated by either gazelle or predator. That is, the gazelle may be entirely oblivious to why it is a good idea to stot if it can, and the predator, say a lion, may not understand why it finds stotting gazelles relatively unattractive prey. But if the signaling wasn't honest, costly signaling, it couldn't persist in the evolutionary arms race between predator and prey. If evolution tried using a cheap signal like tail flicking, which every gazelle, no matter how strong or weak, could send, it wouldn't be worth it for lions to pay attention to it, so they wouldn't. These explanations in terms of free-floating rationales are not reducible to explanations at lower levels, such as the molecular level. But it is important to recognize that even though the explanation of why and how stotting works is from the intentional stance, in terms of what it would be rational for a lion to conclude from the stotting of the gazelle, the individual lion or gazelle need not understand the meaning of stotting for it to work. They need only sorta understand it. 43. Beware of the prime mammal. You may think you're a mammal, and that dogs and cows and whales are mammals, but really there aren't any mammals at all. There couldn't be. Here's a philosophical argument to prove it, drawn with alterations from Sanford, 1975. 1. Every mammal has a mammal for a mother. 2. If there have been any mammals at all, there have been only a finite number of mammals. 3. But if there has been even one mammal, then by 1, there have been an infinity of mammals, which contradicts 2, so there can't have been any mammals. It's a contradiction in terms. Since we know perfectly well that there are mammals, we take this argument seriously only as a challenge to discover what fallacy is lurking within it. It's a straightforward reductio ad absurdum, so something has to give. And we know, in a general way, what has to give. If you go back far enough in the family tree of any mammal, you will eventually get to the therapsids, strange, extinct bridge species between the reptiles and the mammals. A gradual transition occurred from clear reptiles to clear mammals, with a lot of hard-to-classify intermediaries filling in the gaps. What should we do about drawing the lines across this spectrum of gradual change? Can we identify a mammal, the prime mammal, that didn't have a mammal for a mother, thus negating premise one. On what grounds? Whatever the grounds are, they will compete with the grounds we could use to support the verdict that that animal was not a mammal. After all, its mother was a therapsid. What could be a better test of therapsidhood than that? Suppose we list 10 major differences used to distinguish therapsids from mammals, and declare that having 5 or more of the mammal marks makes an animal a mammal. Aside from being arbitrary, why 10 differences instead of 6 or 20? And shouldn't they be ordered in importance? Any such dividing line will generate lots of unwanted verdicts, since during the long, long period of transition between obvious therapsids and obvious mammals, there will be plenty of instances in which mammals, by our 5-plus rule, mated with therapsids, less than 5 mammal marks, and had offspring that were therapsids born of mammals, mammals born of therapsids born of mammals, and so forth. Of course, we would need a time machine to see all these anomalies, since the details are undetectable after all those millions of years. It's just as well, since the details don't really matter in the long run. What should we do? We should quell our desire to draw lines. We don't need to draw lines. We can live with the quite unshocking and unmysterious fact to see all these anomalies, since the details are undetectable after all those millions of years. It's just as well, since the details don't really matter in the long run. What should we do? We should quell our desire to draw lines. We don't need to draw lines. We can live with the quite unshocking and unmysterious fact that all these gradual changes accumulated over many millions of years and eventually produced undeniable mammals. Similarly, the differences between lakes, ponds, and wetlands or marshes do not need to be calibrated, even by limnologists, those who study inland waters. Philosophers, however, tend to be tidy, fussy users of words. Ever since Socrates persisted in demanding to be told precisely what marked the defining features of virtue, knowledge, courage, and the like, philosophers have been tempted by the idea of stopping a threatened infinite regress like this one by identifying something that is, must be, the regress stopper, the prime mammal, in this case. It often lands them in doctrines that wallow in mystery or at least puzzlement, and it commits them to essentialism. The prime mammal must be whichever mammal in the set of mammals was the first to have all the essential mammalian features. If there is no definable essence of mammal, and evolutionary biology shows us that there are no such essences, these philosophers are in trouble. So, as a general rule, consider ignoring the philosopher's demand for an essence, a defining feature, a truth maker. It typically, not always, starts a wild goose chase that may be diverting, but is only moderately illuminating at best. Abandoning this demand is a really bitter pill for many philosophers to swallow. The rational methods for doing philosophy that have been handed down since Socrates almost always call for defining your terms in such a way as to commit everybody in the discussion to a doctrine of essentialism, even if only for the sake of argument, as we say. If we have to abandon essentialism, some of our favorite argument forms are rendered almost useless. Consider, for instance, the structure of arguments that start with an apparently trivially true disjunction. Either A or not A. How can you argue with that? If you choose path A, then blah, 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 so you arrive at conclusion C. And if you start with not A, then blah, 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 you also arrive at C. Therefore, C is established. But what if there are apparently lots of intermediate cases about which it isn't clear whether they are A or not A? Mammals or not mammals, alive or not alive, conscious or not conscious, a belief or not a belief, moral or not moral, etc. In order to brush aside this worry, you must draw a line, distinguishing the A from the not A and banishing all sorta talk. Without that sharp boundary marking the essence of whatever is at stake, the argument simply can't be constructed. Such arguments work brilliantly in mathematics, where you really can draw the lines. Every integer really is odd or even, and every number really is rational or not rational, and every polygon really is a three-sided, triangle or not. Outside of such abstract domains, these arguments fare less well. The instance that there must be a prime mammal, even if we can never know when and where it existed, is an example of hysterical realism. It invites us to reflect that if we just knew enough, we'd have to see, that there is a special property of mammalhood that defines mammals once and for all. To deny this, philosophers sometimes say, is to confuse metaphysics with epistemology, the study of what there really is, with the study of what we can know about what there is. I reply that there may be occasions when thinkers do go off the rails by confusing a metaphysical question with a merely epistemological question. But this must be shown, not just asserted. 44. When does speciation occur? A curious feature of evolution by natural selection is that it depends crucially on events that almost never happen. For instance, speciation, the process in which a new species is generated by wandering away from its parent species, is an exceedingly rare event. But each of the millions of species that have existed on this planet got its start with an event of speciation. Every birth in every lineage is a potential speciation event, but speciation almost never happens, not once in a million births. Mutation in DNA almost never happens, not once in a trillion copyings, but evolution depends on it. Moreover, the vast majority of mutations are either deleterious or neutral. A fortuitously good mutation almost never happens, but evolution depends on those almost rarest of rare events. Consider an intuition pump about a remarkable possibility. At this time, so far as we know, there is just one species of hominid on the planet, Homo sapiens. But suppose that 50 years from now, all but a lucky handful of our descendants are wiped out by a virus that leaves only two groups of survivors, 1,000 Inuit living on remote Cornwallis Island off Greenland, and 1,000 Andamanese living in splendid isolation on islands in the middle of the Indian Ocean. These two populations have been isolated from each other for thousands of years and have developed distinct physiological differences in response to their very different environments. But we have no good reason to question the standard assumption that they are members of our species. Suppose these populations remain both geographically and reproductively isolated for another 10,000 years, eventually repopulating the globe with two species, as they learn when they finally encounter each other and discover they have no interest in mating with each other. And besides, their few inadvertent attempts at mating are fruitless, a standard mark of allopatric speciation. Reproductive isolation produced over time by geographical isolation. They might wonder, when precisely did the speciation occur? It is probably the case that their last common ancestor lived more than 30,000 years ago, but speciation didn't occur then and there, and so far as we know, it hasn't occurred yet. But it still might emerge in a few thousand years that speciation had occurred at some time before the two populations were reunited. Did speciation occur before the dawn of agriculture, or after the creation of the Internet? There is no non-arbitrary answer we could comfortably defend. There must have been a last common ancestor, or concestor, to use Dawkins' 2004 term, living maybe 30,000 years ago. And the offspring of this individual could eventually turn out in the fullness of time to have been the founders of two different species. But it still isn't settled today, one way or the other, whether a speciation event started then. Here we would have an event, a birth that could turn out to have played a pivotal role in human and post-human history, one that occurred in a precise time and place, but didn't acquire its special status until millennia of sequelae had fixed that role, which was never a foregone conclusion. All it would take to prevent that birth from ever having been a speciation event would be a single boatload, or plane load, of islanders making a journey that led to the premature reuniting of the branches. One can imagine that speciation actually occurred at some precise but unknowable moment in the interval between initial isolation of the lineages and the eventual demonstration of their status as two species. But how could such a tipping point be defined? Presumably as the earliest time at which, thanks to the accumulation of chromosomal divergence between the two lineages, if any cross-lineage mating had been attempted, they would have proved infertile. But surmises about such counterfactuals are of scant significance. The building of the Transcontinental Railroad split the herds of American bison into reproductively isolated populations. But Buffalo Bill Cody and his colleagues nipped that potential speciation event in the bud in no time by pretty much wiping out all but one of the populations. Populations of conspecifics often get divided by environmental events into two or more isolated groups, which stay reproductively isolated from each other for a few generations, and almost always either these groups reunite again or one group goes extinct. So although such first steps to speciation must happen fairly often, they almost never lead to speciation. And when they do, it is an outcome that takes many hundreds of generations to establish. Absolutely nothing about the circumstances of the initial separation could tell you whether they were the beginnings of a speciation event, even if you had perfect physical knowledge of every molecule in the world at the time. The very concept of a species is a sorta concept. Domestic dogs, coyotes, and wolves are named as species, and yet coy dogs and dog-wolf offspring are quite common. So, officially, maybe we should consider these as three mere varieties, not even subspecies of Canidae. Generalizations about the possibility of hybridizing, creating offspring from parents of different species, are hard to establish, which is not surprising when you reflect that every individual of every species exhibits subtle differences from every other individual of that species. This does not particularly worry biologists. They have learned not to fret over definitions or essences, since the processes that create all the intermediate cases are well understood. 45. Widowmakers, mitochondrial Eve, and retrospective coronations. A woman in New York City may suddenly acquire the property of being a widow by virtue of the effects that a bullet has just had on some man's brain in Dodge City, over 1,000 miles away. In the days of the Wild West, there was a revolver nicknamed the Widowmaker. Whether a particular revolver lived up to its nickname on a particular occasion might not be settled by even the most exhaustive examination of the scene of the crime. The example gets its curious capacity to leap through space and time from the conventional nature of the relationship of marriage, in which a past historical event, a wedding, is deemed to create a permanent relation, a formal relation, not a causal relation, of interest in spite of subsequent wanderings and concrete misfortunes, the accidental loss of a ring or the destruction of the marriage certificate, for instance. The system of genetic reproduction is natural, not conventional, but it works like clockwork. And that very systematicity permits us to think formally about causal chains extending over millions of years, causal chains that would otherwise be virtually impossible to designate or refer to or track. This permits us to become